In Belt and Road negotiation, instead of going to the European Union level, China so far has gone country by country.
Chinese President Xi Jinping finds some Silk Road in Europe. It's Wednesday, March 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us today. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, getting aid inside North Korea. A film to help young women embrace becoming an adult. The business of small trees and tracking devices. Ocean heat waves and a cinematic look at our changing climate. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed Monday to work with European leaders to seek fairer international trade rules and to address the world's economic and security challenges, establishing what he termed a trust-based partnership. Xi, who is on a state visit to France, met in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker to discuss relations between China and Europe. Macron acknowledged existing rivalries between the European Union and China over economic policies, but the four said in a joint statement after the meeting that they committed to seeking a trust-based partnership. Saturday, Italy signed a memorandum of understanding with China, supporting Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative, which aims to weave a network of ports, bridges, and power plants linking China with Africa, Europe, and beyond. With the move, Italy becomes the first member of the group of seven major economies, which includes the United States, to join the Belt and Road program, following Portugal's embrace of the initiative in December. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Nicholas Varone, senior fellow at both the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington and the Bruegel Institute in Brussels about Xi Jinping's efforts so far.
I think here you see the contrast between the Italian visit and the French visit, because the Italians tried, like smaller European member states had done, to do a kind of separate deal with China, not with much coordination at the European level. And that became very controversial in Italy, not to mention other parts of Europe, whereby the message from France is that he insisted on meeting President Xi Jinping together with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, therefore giving a message that China would not succeed with a strategy of divide and rule in Europe. So there is a willingness to engage, but in a coordinated European way.
Explain to me what you mean by the Chinese attempt to divide and rule.
So in the Belt and Road discussions, not in other areas like, you know, fighting climate change or defending the World Trade Organization, but in Belt and Road negotiation, instead of going to the European Union level, China so far has gone country by country. So they've tried to make deals with individual member states of the European Union without prompting much coordination at the European level. And of course, if you sit in Brussels and you see that happening, your instinctive reaction is to say, well, China is trying to undermine European efforts and to pick pieces instead of negotiating with the whole of Europe. And that's exactly been Brussels' reaction, encapsulated in a recent strategy paper on the relationship between the European Union and China.
What is the correlation between China's moves, especially in the EU, and the change in course as far as U.S. policy is concerned?
I'm not sure there is a very observable correlation. I think it's very clear that the U.S. stance vis-à-vis China has crystallized probably in the second half of last year. You remember the speech, very hawkish speech by Vice President Mike Pence at the Hudson Institute, for example. So there is a greater hostility to China that you feel in the U.S., and I don't think it's just President Trump. It goes way beyond. It's both sides of the political aisle. It's the security community. It's increasingly also big parts of the business community in the U.S. So you have this kind of hostility that has crystallized last year against China in the U.S. I don't see anything really comparable in Europe. I think there is concern about encroachment by China, including by China, you know, picking individual countries for its Belt and Road Initiative, but it's a more nuanced view generally. I think Europe understands that the world is becoming more difficult for them. The U.S. is not friendly to European integration. China is becoming bigger and is a different model, but they haven't made any choice strategically to antagonize China in the European Union. So I think it's the correlation with U.S. moves is indirect. Even so, of course, everything is linked in those matters.
Is Xi Jinping a winner here, or will be a winner here when it comes to the EU or not?
Well, I think the deal with Italy was a win in the short term because it allowed, you know, good images on TV, Xi Jinping heralding, signing something for the first time with a G7 country. Now, whether it's good or bad in the long term for or win or loss for China in the medium to long term is more judgmental because that move, because Italy didn't coordinate with its European and American allies, has created some bad blood, and I think that will need to be dealt with.
Nicholas Varone, senior fellow at both the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington and the Bruegel Institute in Brussels, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you log on to voanews.com. Pompeo calls on China to stop abhorrent practice of interning Uyghur Muslims. China and EU stress importance of multilateralism. Humanitarian groups say sanctions impede aid to North Koreans. Myanmar's top court to rule on jailed journalists' appeal. Asia's coal addiction puts chokehold on its air-polluted cities. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found where else? Facebook at VOA Asia and also our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Humanitarian groups are continuing to face complications, including funding shortfalls when delivering aid to North Korea, as the United States maintains its maximum pressure sanctions campaign on the country. The United Nations granted sanctions exemption to 5 humanitarian organizations earlier this month. That raised the total of groups that can deliver aid to North Korea to 21. Humanitarian agencies said sanctions placed on North Korea have created complications for aid groups that need to secure funds and deliver assistance to the country. The UN and U.S. have placed rounds of sanctions on North Korea since 2016, following its nuclear and ballistic missile tests. North Korea is one of the lowest-funded countries in the world, according to a 2019 DPRK Needs and Priorities Plan. That's a report issued earlier this month by the United Nations. With an estimated 11 million men, women, and children lacking sufficient nutritious food, clean drinking water, or access to basic health and sanitation services, in 2018, North Korea received less than half of the $111 million that international humanitarian agencies deemed necessary. This year, the UN is appealing for $120 million to cover aid for the most vulnerable 3.8 million North Koreans. We thank Christy Lee and An Soo Young of VOA's Korean service who contributed to this report. Happening now in Asia as quickly as North Korea withdrew personnel from a joint liaison office in Kaesong Friday, Pyongyang returned Monday without explanation. The inter-Korean liaison office was open following the third summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Stay up to date with VOA. Listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by. A documentary entitled Period, End of Sentence, which won an Oscar last month, centers on a small village in Uttar Pradesh state in northern India, where a machine to make affordable sanitary napkins was installed with the help of a crowdfunding initiative by a student group in the United States. The film has flipped attitudes toward the subject of menstruation and lifted the age-old stigma that often negatively impacted young girls and women. Anjana Pasricha brings us this report.
The women working in the small manufacturing unit making sanitary pads in Kathikhera village had never heard that word while growing up. That is no surprise. Menstruation is a taboo subject in village homes. That is why when the venture was launched over 2 years ago, several people quit after being taunted for doing dirty work. Those who persevered did not dare acknowledge what they were doing.
We used to tell everyone we are making diapers. When people came to buy them, we were very embarrassed to admit that we were actually making pads.
All that has changed since these women became the subject of a documentary that nabbed the Oscar this year. Period, end of sentence, chronicles the impact of the cultural stigma that surrounds the subject in India. Many girls drop out of school. Menstrual hygiene poses a challenge. The movie's protagonist, Sneha, who was once scoffed by villagers for her work, is now respected. More importantly, the making of the film has broken the silence around the once taboo word.
Those who didn't want to listen about this subject or talk to us now converse about it more openly to us and to each other. It is treated as a normal topic. This is a huge opportunity. This is what we wanted, that it should not be considered a dirty subject.
These women get a willing ear when they visit village homes to explain about sanitary products instead of being turned away. Sanitary pads are openly stocked in a village shop. Mothers say they will discuss the topic with young daughters.
These foreigners who came to make the movie have removed the shame we used to feel.
There have been other gains, financial independence and a newfound determination to achieve goals. Sneha aspires to become a police officer, Rakhi a teacher. Village officials have become more open to discussing women's issues with Action India, the charity that helped set up the venture.
When we used to hold meetings to create awareness about menstrual hygiene, they used to say that we are spoiling their women. We were heavily criticized. Now that atmosphere has changed. They want to join hands with us. They ask us about our problems.
As village homes welcome the women, the hope is that the social revolution ushered in by the film will resonate in other parts of rural India. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Kathikhera, Uttar Pradesh.
Coming up, planting small to grow big profits. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, Myanmar's Supreme Court agreed to rule Tuesday on an appeal by two Reuters journalists who have been sentenced to 7 years for their news coverage of Myanmar's violent suppression of Rohingya Muslims. The judge cited 13 grounds on which he believed judicial procedure was violated. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Malaysia hopes small trees will help its palm oil industry stand tall, while Japanese store items get individual tracking. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
The Malaysian Palm Oil Board is undergoing an initiative to breed small dwarf trees in response to problems in the palm oil industry. Prices for palm oil have fallen recently because of sluggish demand from some importers, and the industry's image has been damaged by environmental groups who say the rapid expansion of plantations has damaged the jungles as well as tribespeople's lands. The Malaysian government hopes the dwarf tree program will cut costs and limit environmental damage. The trees are 30% smaller and produce twice the amount of palm oil per hectare as the current trees do. but many challenges remain. The dwarf trees went on sale in 2017 and were slow to sell. At about $7 each, the seedlings are around twice the price of conventional varieties, and many small farmers cannot afford them. The European Parliament also recently banned the use of palm oil in biofuels, classifying them as unsustainable. Despite the many environmental and economic challenges, the breeding program continues, and dwarf palm oil trees have been planted in several areas in Malaysia. Convenience stores in Japan have started to use electronic tags to manage their food supply. Until now, employees have had to check the shelf life of their products 3 to 4 times a day, usually requiring staff to check products one by one. The electronic tags enable store employees to see the stock size and the trading volume via wireless scanning, making it more convenient for the store to adjust the purchase quantity and thereby reduce the waste of goods. The electronic tag system sharply reduces the number of workers needed at cash registers and for inventory management. Ken Machimaru is from the Department of Public Relations at Lawson Incorporation.
It shortens the employees' amount of time spent doing register work in the store on a daily basis and helps the shop assistants work more efficiently.
Electronic tagging has not been mainstreamed yet because of its high price, but stores are hoping that with the development of the technology and mass production, these costs will be reduced. According to the Consumer Affairs Agency of Japan, the country throws away nearly 28 million tons of food waste every year, nearly 30% of which is thrown away near its expiration date. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Australia's nationalist One Nation Party allegedly sought millions of dollars from the U.S. gun lobby and discussed weakening the country's strict gun control laws with the U.S. National Rifle Association. Australia introduced laws banning foreign political donations in November last year. Always granting full access to everyone is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, parts of our oceans routinely go through temperature swings. The El Niño and La Niña effects in the Pacific are perhaps the best known, but new research in Britain suggests that those heat waves are becoming more common and more extreme. And VOA's Kevin Enix tells us that spells trouble for the world's waters.
The new research says that while oceans are constantly fluctuating in temperature, these days they are getting hotter a lot more often.
In that 60-year difference, we saw an increase in over 50% of the number of marine heatwave days that you could expect across the globe in any one year.
Dan Smale works for Britain's Marine Biological Association. He says that while marine heatwaves aren't uncommon, they're becoming more common because in many places, climate change is raising the average temperature of ocean water.
There's natural fluctuations in temperature in the oceans and the atmosphere. But when they happen now, because of background global warming and ocean warming, when they happen, they tend to occur in regions that have become much warmer in recent decades, and so the starting point for these events is much hotter than it used to be.
The result is that the plants and animals that live in these areas are having trouble dealing with the increased heat.
Where the heat waves are really intense or really long-lasting, then we've seen large-scale die-offs of these foundation species and consequent changes in entire ecosystems.
Seagrass and kelp are particularly sensitive, and like coral reefs, these kelp forests are huge islands of biodiversity. And when they get stressed, the whole system suffers.
We've seen in the Mediterranean, where they've lost loads of seagrass, huge changes in biodiversity and ecosystem structure. And similarly in Australia, on both the east and the west coast, we've seen large-scale loss of kelp forest habitat, marine forests, and that's led to large-scale losses of biodiversity and changes in function.
The solution, of course, is to stop the climate change that is driving the warming.
If we really want to mitigate the effects of these marine heat waves, we need to quite urgently reduce greenhouse gas emissions and move away from a carbon-based economy.
Seaweed and kelp also act as carbon sinks, soaking up a lot of the excess carbon we're pumping into the atmosphere. So keeping these forests intact, Smil says, is a big part of fighting climate change. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Washington, D.C. played host to the 27th Annual Environmental Film Festival, where over 100 films were showcased in 25 locations around the city. And many of them focused on the human impact on climate change worldwide, pointing to severe weather phenomena already underway, such as rising sea levels and disappearing biodiversity. VOA's Penelope Palou spoke with filmmakers who came to D.C. to present their work.
Humans go from being participants in the whole Earth to being a dominant feature.
The documentary Anthropocene shows the impact of humans on the planet. Anthropocene was one of 100 films showcased at the 27th Annual Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital.
It is such a fundamental change in the way the Earth is behaving that we need to communicate that as powerfully as possible to everybody.
Similarly, Welcome to Sodom documents the world's largest electronic waste dump in Ghana. Hundreds of thousands of electronic equipment gets dismantled by children and adolescents in toxic smoke. In Sharkwater Extinction, the late filmmaker Rob Stewart shows how illegal fishing practices threaten the survival of sharks.
We're killing up to 150 million sharks a year.
Sharks are now renamed and fed to us. Pet food, livestock feed, and even in cosmetics.
We depend on other species for survival. Removing sharks is removing part of the framework that allows life to exist on land.
In Groundwork, Canadian filmmaker Andrew Nisker raises questions about the health impact of chemicals used to maintain green, weed-free golf courses, lawns, and playgrounds. Nisker told VOA how his documentary evolved as he was seeking answers on the causes of his father's cancer. His father was an avid golf player who died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Glyphosate, Roundup is one of those brand names of the chemical.
He said so far, two plaintiffs with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma have won multi-million dollar rulings against the manufacturer of weed killer Roundup.
People are waking up to the fact that what is being put on lawns and parks and gardens are not benign.
In The River and the Wall, filmmaker Ben Masters treks 1,200 miles by the Rio Grande along the U.S.-Mexico border to examine what impact a contiguous border wall would have on the environment and the local ranchers.
Is the border on the river or is the border at the wall?
Without the water, we can't operate.
We need strong borders. We have to stop drugs and crime and criminals and human trafficking, and we have to stop all of those things that a strong wall will stop.
Masters told VOA a contiguous wall along the Rio Grande River, and especially in the lower Rio Grande Valley, would cut the water supply of many animal species trapped on the one side and would change the area's ecological makeup.
They're building it through some national wildlife refuges and a bunch of really important habitat in this area that's this major conduit of migratory flyways for songbirds, bats, and butterflies.
As the fire season nears, Alex Jablonski's documentary Wildland hits home, chronicling the grueling training of wildland firefighters and their bonding during the long hours of hauling equipment and hiking ridgelines to fight fires. Jablonski had to train and get a firefighter's license with the rest of the group in order to shoot the documentary.
What are these guys really like? And can we tell a story where if you hear about a fire on the news, if you see, you know, wildfire footage, you actually stop for a moment and think about the people who are actually fighting them?
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. If you happen to be in Taipei, Taiwan, perhaps you heard us on the radio. CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei carries our program. We thank everyone there who is tuned in today. We thank you as well if you've listened via VOA Asia Facebook. Thanks to Yellen Chun, who brought you our live stream today. And also on our website at voanews.com. Our director, who we always like to thank, is Tracy Carter, engineer Cedric Franklin, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead.